The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello and welcome to the last in the series of the Round Golf Podcast. And I'm really delighted that this episode is the final one. I always thought Mel Reid would be a fantastic guest to have. And I think once you've listened, you will agree that she is. She's outspoken, she's talented. Her life and her golf has been a real roller coaster of emotions and mixed fortunes. Now, this hour with Mel covers most of the major moments she's been through. The extremely talented youngster who was set to conquer the world, partook in an experiment from a World Cup winning rugby coach. There's the early years on the Ladies European Tour where success came, leading of course to a Solheim Cup debut. Then the tragedy that struck her, losing her mother in a horrific car crash, and the difficulties that inevitably brought to her life. And how it's only in the last year she feels she's come to terms with things properly, coinciding with her decision to publicly say that she is gay. Now, all of this is covered in the episode, along with her thoughts, opinions about women in sport, how much the Solheim Cup means to her. So enjoy, and if you do, please tell someone you might think also would like a listen. Here's Mel.
I kind of want to do this a little bit differently. So I've got this interview that I found. Obviously, you know, it's the round, and we talk mm-hmm. about the round and what came before and what mm-hmm. came after, but your round is quite recently.
Right.
Two things. This is an interview I found in 2008.
Okay.
And I just wonder what you think in terms of how golf has maybe changed. This was with the Times.
Okay.
These are the questions. It was like a Q&A. So it wasn't a proper interview as in Mel Reid's done this, Mel, you know, it was question and you had to answer. So these are the first three questions that you had to answer, and just want to know if you're surprised or not by them. First question is, well, more of a statement, really. It says, you don't look like a typical lady golfer. The next question is, actually a question, always hit the course with your face on? And then the last question that followed that was, many male admirers, ?
Did they interview me with that?
Yes. So you've answered, women golfers aren't what people think anymore. In terms of you don't look like a typical lady golfer. You say you put makeup to feel good about yourself. And many male admirers, you said there are some.
Right.
I mean, I hope no one nowadays would ever start an interview with you like mm-hmm. that. But does that show maybe a little bit how things have maybe moved on?
I mean, I would like to think so. I think that a lot more women are kind of standing up for equality now. And, you know, there's a lot more women that are taking part in sport nowadays than probably what there was back in 2008 as well. And getting a lot more publicity, like the England women football team are now professional. So now we have, you know, the Women's Premier League now, that's professional. England cricket's now professional, women. Rugby's now professional, women. So yeah, I mean, I certainly think that times have definitely changed. I'm quite, I was obviously awkward at them answers, yeah.
I mean, that's the Times, it's not a tabloid.
I know, it's crazy. I mean, I'd like to think that it's definitely moved forward. I don't get... The thing is now, I'm obviously a bit more mature and I'm much more aware of things like that now. So I think that if I got asked that now, I just wouldn't answer the question.
I mean, you were only 20.
Yeah, I was a baby. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that times have definitely moved on and we wouldn't be getting questions about male admirers and, you know, how we look and, you know.
So that,
those sort of, they're inappropriate questions. You'd never ask that to a male athlete.
No, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredible. That was your rookie season, 2008.
Yeah, and like this is the thing that frustrates me is that obviously on social media, like we're on a platform where we can have an opinion and people then have a platform back to us almost a lot easier than what it used to be. But you wouldn't believe some of the things that male fans, whatever you want, we want to call them, you know, kind of say things to us. Oh, it doesn't really matter, like, why are you fighting for equality? Well, you don't have to deal with stuff like that. Like, the women in sport have so much more to deal with in terms of, you know, these kind of questions. Even, like, now, it's nowhere near as bad. It's a lot more respected, women's sport. But you still obviously get certain questions that are just, that a male athlete would just never even need to be asked, basically. Yeah, and so people, you know, not necessarily men, like even women say it to me as well, and I'm like, you don't know what it's like. Being in women's sport is, you know, very different to male sport.
Yeah, hopefully I'm not going to ask you any questions that go down that route at all. But 2008, so you were, when those questions were asked, mm-hmm. you were a ladies' European Tour rookie. You've mentioned there how, well, you know, football and other sports have mm-hmm. moved on. At the age of 20, you'd been a pretty good footballer, hadn't you,
yeah.
growing up?
Mm-hmm.
So was there a decision at some point to play golf or football?
I mean, certainly. I think that I was a pretty decent footballer. You know, could I have taken it all the way? I would like to think so. But, you know, the reason I didn't is because I didn't really know how far I could have taken it, whereas I knew how far I could take golf. So for me, that's kind of was the defining reason, really, was I just didn't really know. I felt like there was a limit with football, whereas with golf, I didn't feel like there was.
Did you think a limit in terms of where the game was?
Yeah, I think in terms of where the game was, financially as well, I didn't think I could. So I always wanted to be an athlete. There's no other question what I wanted to be kind of growing up.
Since how old?
Since I was, literally can remember. The only other thing I ever wanted to be was a vet. That was the only other thing. But I always wanted to be an athlete. I knew I'd always be. Like, people joke around now, like, if I wasn't a professional athlete, I would still be heavily involved in sport in some way. Like, I'd probably be in CrossFit or something like that, like, as a hobby. But for me, the defining moment really is I felt like there was a limit with football. It wasn't as popular as it is now, and I just didn't really know how far I could take it. And I obviously fell in love with golf very quickly, and so it was kind of an easy decision for me.
So you're in your early 30s now. Do you still play football at all?
I do a little, like, nowhere near as much. I still played pretty competitive until about 3 or 4 years ago.
When you say competitive, what level?
So I played for Loughborough Foxes for a little bit. Well, I played for them since 20 to about 27.
So what standard are they?
We're the Northern Prem, which is one or two leagues below kind of the Man Cities. But we used to play against decent teams like Newcastle United, Nottingham Forest. But yeah, I mean, it was a bunch of my mates that finished uni, all happened to be good footballers. And we kind of developed, well, one of my friends developed this team and, you know, we just happened to be quite good at it. So, but yeah, obviously I got to a point where the training and stuff and then playing golf,
Sure.
I couldn't take it. Yeah, I just did it for fun. And then when we got actually quite good, I decided to probably retire early and get out of it before I embarrass myself.
Okay. But I mean, this competitive spirit you had, this little girl that knew that she wanted to do professional sport, family-wise, was there a sport, competitive environment? What pulled that out for
it's,
you?
No, I don't know. I mean, I'm one of seven. I'm the youngest by 11 years. So my parents were almost the opposite. Like, my mum and dad were both very athletic, but never really too competitive. They never pushed me in any way. They just kind of let me do it and guided me along the way. Honestly, it was just literally the love of sport that I just enjoyed so much. Like, I just would get up, play football before school, play football at lunch, play football after school. I've been skiing since I was 18 months old, snowboarded since I was five, like, was a good tennis player as a kid, played squash since I was five. So I kind of did everything. Like, sport was just, has always been kind of a huge part of my life.
So the fact that you were the youngest, that maybe could have brought the competitive fight from you. Do you think, I mean, for example, I know one of your heroes is Damo, Laura Davis,
yeah, mm-hmm.
you know, and it was playing with her older mm-hmm. brother, made mm-hmm. her want to fight to be at that level.
Yeah. Honestly, I think so. And I think I grew up with, like, a lot of boys. And so I think that made me a little bit more competitive, just being the only girl in the group. Like, I wanted to prove a point to people. Like, I was the only girl in my football league, like, my team when I was growing up. So I think that I always wanted to be not seen as a girl, almost. I wanted to be seen as an athlete. Like, even from a very young age, I didn't want to be defined like, oh, she's pretty good for a girl. It was always like, oh, she's a very good player. Like, that's kind of how I wanted to always be noticed, I guess, more so than, oh, she's, you know, I didn't ever want it to be seen as, oh, she's not bad for a girl. I wanted to be seen like, wow, she's a really good footballer.
Yeah, I suppose the same in golf, because
yeah.
you know, when you were doing the internationals and stuff, you mixed with the boys, mm-hmm. like the likes of Rory mm-hmm. McIlroy. Mm-hmm. So was that the same there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's extremely healthy for girls to grow up in competitive sport with boys. I feel like boys are naturally a bit more competitive, naturally a little bit more creative. And so I would always encourage, you know, if I had children one day and I had girls, I would always encourage them to kind of play sport with boys, honestly, because I just think it's extremely healthy for girls to be brought up in that environment.
So I know you've snowboarding, skiing, there's obviously a lot of sport going on. So golf, where did that come in?
My parents played like casually. My dad would play every Saturday, just very socially. My brother was pretty decent. He was off kind of scratch, and then...
How old? So you've got an older brother.
Yeah,
who's
Craig.
Who's off scratch.
He's off, yeah, he was pretty much off scratch. He's...
And how older than you is he?
He's...
I know, it's
tough. His birthday's soon. He's 14 years older than me.
Okay, so there's a level to...
Yeah.
To aspire to.
But I never really played with him that much, because he was obviously 16 and I was 2. So I played because a lot of my friends that I used to play football with went to the golf club, like, for 6 weeks holiday. So when they kind of finished playing football, 11 or 12, they went into that. So it was very easy for my mum to kind of say, oh, why don't you go with, like, Matt and Will and all those boys? And I'd be like, oh, okay, sure. So I actually did it originally for the social aspect of it. And I very quickly kind of fell in love with it. And it was perfect for my parents, because in the 6 weeks holiday, they'd drop me off at 7:30 in the morning and then pick me up at 8, 9 o'clock at night. So it was like a perfect daycare almost while they were working. So yeah, that's kind of, and then all my mates again at golf were boys, and we just would play literally 45 holes a day.
And how long was it before you were really good at the game?
I don't know. There's a kind of a turning point when I was about 13. I got in the England squads, and obviously then it became a little bit more professional, and then I got off scratch at 15, I think. And then that was it really. I knew from about 15 that's what I wanted to do for a career.
Okay. And how long was it before, because I know about this Clive Woodward mm-hmm. thing, the Olympics.
Yeah.
How long before he and his team got involved with you? When was that?
About, I was about 18 years old.
Okay.
It happened at a right time, actually, because I was going to do my A-levels. I was then going to go to America for university. I happened to, through my coach at the time, Lawrence Farmer, put me in touch with Clive Woodward. And it was a really, really good program for me, because it taught me...
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt just so people might not know.
Sure.
Clive Woodward was the World Cup winning coach mm-hmm. of England rugby.
Yep.
And then he was working for the British Olympic Association.
Yep.
And he wanted to give a blueprint, didn't he?
A blueprint for the perfect environment.
Yeah.
So you, the player and the coach were in the middle of he used to call it a cog system. And then you'd have coaches around you. I mean, at one point I think I had 14. But they were all different, you know, you'd have a physio, a doctor, psychologist, preparation coach, skill coach, profiling coach, strength and conditioning coach. Like, there was just a nutrition, everything you could ever imagine, no kind of stone was unturned. And it was great for me for the 18 months to 2 years I was on it, because it gave me a huge amount of discipline. And it really did prepare me really for professional golf, but obviously to maintain 14 people is quite difficult. So when I turned pro, I only kept probably 2 or 3 of them.
Because if you look at some of the modern, particularly male golfers, they almost have that kind of entourage, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I get it. Like, it's so competitive now that, you know, they don't leave any percent as a maybe, you know.
But did it ever feel too much having all that?
Yeah. Like, I was just constantly... I didn't do anything else, honestly, for about 2 years. And so it's a lot to kind of deal with 18 years old. It made me grow up very quickly, but it also, it was a lot at times, for sure. Like, there's certain people I thought in there that I didn't necessarily felt benefited me as much as, say, the other people in there. So at 18 years old, I kind of just did what they said, because obviously you don't know. And then looking back, you know, I only probably would have kept, like I said, when I turned pro, I only kept probably 2 or 3 of them, which was a lot easier to manage.
Sure.
Obviously.
And when you turn pro, a lot less expensive, obviously, mm-hmm. as well. I mean, before you turn pro, you've won the English Girls Championships twice. You played Curtis mm-hmm. Cup, Junior Solheim Cup. You were the top amateur at the Women's British Open 2007. So I'm giving this kind of list. The expectations were, when you turn pro, mm-hmm. you were going to be one of the, you know, the big stars of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Pressure-wise, when people were talking like that, did it affect you at all? Or
no.
Were you happy to hear that?
I relished in it, honestly. I think that I've always said this, if you're not cocky and fearless at 20, 21, then you've got zero chance out here. And that's exactly what I was. I was completely fearless. I had no scars. I had no damage, you know, and I thought I was going to be the best in the world. And so, you know, nothing intimidated me, quite honestly. But like I said, if you come out and you're not like that, you really don't have a chance, because the more years you spend on tour, you know what it's like. Like you do get a couple more scars and a couple more cuts and bruises as you play, the longer you play. And so it does get harder the kind of longer you're out here.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk more about this maybe a little bit later in the interview, if that's okay. But the confidence thing, because you're quite a confident person talking now, mm-hmm. away from the golf course. I've heard you recently say that you're not a confident person necessarily on the course, but that obviously wasn't always the way then.
No, it was the opposite. It was quite funny. I was more confident on a golf course than I was off. Now, just I think honestly, just due to me growing up, me being 31, stuff I've had to deal with in life, I feel a lot more confident off the golf course. I think at times I search too much for perfection on the golf course. I think that's my issue, whereas when I was younger, even if I was hitting it sideways, I still believed that I'd be able to get it round. Whereas now I'm much more like I have to be hitting it perfect, which I'm learning that that's not the case, but it's just difficult because, like I said, I've been out here for, 10 years now. And so I think the strength and depth on the tour is so much stronger than what it was, that you have to be on it every week.
Yeah, so those early years, mm-hmm. you know, this confident young lady comes on, mm-hmm. want to be the best, and the signs were there that you know, rookie of the year, your first year on tour, countless top tens, second year on tour. Then you won for the first time, didn't you, 2010 in Turkey. 2011, another couple of wins, Solheim mm-hmm. Cup debut. So the career was heading all in the right direction.
Yeah, for sure. I really should have won two or three times in my rookie year, honestly. I finished second, I think, four times or something. So, and two of them I had a massive lead. So, yeah, I mean, I was progressing exactly the way that I feel like you should have done. I had two or three years in Europe, and then I wanted to go to America. So, yeah, my career at that point was definitely on the right track.
Yeah, that first Solheim, so you've won a couple of times already.
Yeah.
What was that, you know, looking back now as well, what was that experience like for you playing?
That was one of the best experiences of my life, just because of the team that we had and the captain that we had as well. And, you know, I'm not saying that the other ones were not as special, but this one was just particularly special because obviously it was my first one. I think your first Solheim is always extremely special, but you know, Ali Nick I thought was a great captain. I got to play with Laura.
So let me touch on that then, because when did Laura become this figure of...
She always has been since I was a kid. I remember watching her a little bit on TV. She was only really the only women golfer that I knew, honestly. It's the only one that kind of the media would talk about. And I just really liked how natural she was, and I felt like I could relate to her more so than, say, an Annika Sorensen, who's very regimented and very analytical and is into numbers. Like, that's just not what I'm about. I'm much more about, oh, let's see if I can draw it around this tree. And I feel that that's where I can relate to Laura much more than, say, an Annika Sorensen. And that's no disrespect to Annika at all. It's just, I just feel...
I bet that was hard then, if that was your instinct mm-hmm. when you were doing this Clive Woodward.
Yeah.
Because I assume everything was examined then.
Exactly, but it was good at the same time because I also need a little bit of discipline. So it was like one extreme to another, and then I found like a happy medium eventually.
Okay, so 2011, you played with Laura.
Yeah.
You got Alison Nicholas, who's, you know, as you're saying, is a great captain to play for. Because it can be difficult, can't it, being a rookie in a Solheim Cup?
Yeah, I mean, it really can. I always say that the hardest Solheim is your first one. If you win one match, you've had a very successful Solheim Cup in your first one. Because it is very different. And, you know, especially it was easier it was in Ireland. I think if it was in America, my first one, I would have found it a little bit more challenging. But, yeah, I mean, I just obviously we won as well, which kind of just was the icing on the cake, really. And had my whole family there, and It was just an incredible week for me.
Yeah, no, I was there myself, especially, and you know, you were very much part of of the team, weren't you? You contributed to a special week. Obviously, the following year, you know, events just completely turn your life upside down. And I remember I spoke to Davis Love III about this. Davis did an interview with me, and he lost his father in a plane crash. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, you know, people sometimes forget sports people are human beings, and you had to live through the grief in public. And how hard was that? I mean, how hard was it for you, obviously, having to deal, I mean, with something as tragic as that, but in a public way as well.
Yeah, I mean, it changes you as a person, quite honestly. I don't think you ever quite get over something like that. And, you know, doing it in the public, like everybody kind of speculated, you know, or exaggerated the way that I was behaving, which was a little bit unfair, to be honest, because at the time I was kind of doing my best. Obviously, I would have done things differently. I would have stepped away from the game for at least until I felt comfortable again, or at least until I wanted to play again. But at the time, I thought I was doing the right thing.
Yeah, so I'm just, because again, I can't assume everyone listening knows, mm-hmm. your mum and dad were in a car crash,
yeah.
and obviously your mother passed away from the injuries that she suffered. You've said in the past that you don't want to not talk about that, mm-hmm. because of obviously the memories you have about your mum.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's also, it's made me who I am now. I think I'd be a very different person if she was still here. But again, it certainly changes you as a person. It changes your perspective on life. And, you know, it just makes you see things come from a completely different angle, I guess.
Yeah, stop me if you don't have to answer every question. Mm-hmm. But what do you miss most from her?
Just the mum, quite honestly. Like, I just, you know, I think it's always hard when somebody misses her. Especially, I'm very fortunate I get on really well with my parents. My dad's like my best mate, he always has been, whereas my mum was, you know, just a complete mum. So I kind of just miss having her around. I miss, obviously, like, the fact she's not going to see me have a family. I miss the fact that she's not seeing the kids grow up, like her grandkids. You know, and I feel bad for my dad as well. Like, you know, they were a really cool partnership and something quite special. And, you know, it's not just me I kind of feel bad for, it's kind of the whole family and what she's missing out on. But, you know, we're a pretty tight-knit family, and we've obviously tried to keep, you know, as much as possible, we try and keep her feeling like she's kind of around. So for me, that's probably the biggest thing, is just missing that aspect, just having a mum to kind of talk to.
Yeah, I mean, I knew of your mum. I didn't know your mum, obviously. But I remember at the time, and the players, other players devastated as well, because she used to put an arm around quite a few shoulders, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She was a proper mum on tour. Like, everyone kind of got, she just would hug everyone. She was just, from a little girl, she wanted to be a mum, and she was a mum to all of us. And so that's who she was. She was just a mum.
Your dad are you very much like your dad?
I'm very similar to my dad, yeah. We're a bit carnage together, because we're just the same person. Like, we've never had an argument. You know, we're literally best mates. Like, I'm basically a female version of him, which I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. But, I mean, obviously I have certain parts of my mum, like, you know, the sensitive and the mumsy side. But, I mean, I'm very much like my dad. I always have been.
You mentioned before about how, you know, you might have done things different, because within 4 weeks, you won a golf tournament. Mm-hmm. I mean, if people want to know about your inner strength, that says a lot. But you mentioned there you maybe regretted coming back.
Yeah, I mean, that was honestly probably, it was the best and worst thing that happened really after it, because I kind of came out of that after winning in Prague thinking I was okay, which I definitely wasn't. I don't think it, I just wasn't for a very long time. I mean, you know, there's still hard days even now, and it's been, what, 7 years? So it's, I just wish if I could do things differently, I wish that I just took the rest of the year off, you know, just regrouped a little bit, took the time I needed to deal with what I was dealing with and be around my family and people that I really, really trusted. And
so what were people saying to you?
Weren't necessarily saying things, but one, it's kind of difficult when something that tragic happens, people don't know how to act around you. You know, it got exaggerated, like I was going out all the time and la-di-da-di-da. I was and I wasn't at the same time. Like, I just didn't want to play golf. And I was kind of not getting forced into it. Like, I obviously had a choice as well. But, you know, that's all I'd done is play golf. So that was kind of my security blanket. But I think the way that she passed away at a golf tournament is what I struggled with the most. Like, I just struggled being on a golf course for a long, long time.
So how, it obviously is a memory now, that event in Prague. How did you get to the first tee? How did you?
Was
it autopilot? What was going
it's
on?
It's funny, like, I had a couple of my best mates there. Johnny was on the bag with me, who's my best mate's partner. I just honestly didn't, sounds awful, I just didn't care. And I think that helped me. I didn't care where it went. I didn't care how I did. And so I just played completely free. I had no expectation on me whatsoever. And it was really funny. I kind of said to Johnny at the start of the week, I was like, I'm not even going to practice this week, Johnny. I'm not even going to look at the course. Like, I'm either going to win or miss the cut by 10. There's no in between. And we happen to win.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the next couple of years, and I suppose not without any real surprise, mm-hmm. really. I mean, it's a huge surprise you go and win a tournament. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things catch up, don't
they?
Yeah,
of course they do, yeah.
And so this thing that people, you know, saying, and you've mentioned it there, that things get exaggerated. Yeah. I don't think anyone would blame you for going a little off the rails. Mm-hmm. But you're saying it's been blown out.
It's been massively blown out of proportion, yeah. I mean, obviously I hang out with my mates more, but it was because I didn't want to play golf. So instead of practicing 6 days a week, I was practicing maybe one. So the other 5 days I was hanging out with either friends or family. So, you know, how do you deal with things sometimes when people, you go, oh, should we just go, let's just do this, let's do that. And so I was like, yeah, all right. You know, it is going to make me feel better.
Did you have counselling at all or anything like that?
My sister wanted me to. I did for a little bit. I didn't really feel it benefited me that much. I'm stubborn when I want to be. Like, if I don't want to deal with something, I don't deal with it. So it was completely pointless, really. Honestly, this sounds really, really, really funny, but I've actually only felt I've dealt with it, honestly, this winter. It's
really?
Probably the first time I've dealt with it, yeah, properly, yeah.
So we're going back...
7 years.
7 years.
It's so the first time.
What, so go on, let's skip forward. So what happened this winter that made you deal with it then?
I moved to America, which was huge to me because I did never wanted to leave my dad, but I felt like I was almost stopping living my life though I wanted to because I was worried about him. And he's fine. Like, he's got an amazing social life. He's, you know, he's 82, but he's fit as a butcher's dog. And, you know, he's living his life. And I felt like I kind of just couldn't because I was always either worrying about him or I just didn't want to leave him. So for me to finally almost break free from that was kind of a bit of a relief, if that makes sense. Like, I remember telling him, I said, look, if you don't want me to leave, I won't. He's like, well, I don't, like, of course you should leave. Like, this is your life, you know? And he didn't really know that I'd kind of been doing that, so.
I mean, had you not broached that subject with him before?
Not then? Really, like, yeah, I mean, I've just always put him first, above anything. You know, if my friends wanted to go out and then he was like, oh, do you want to go into town with me? I'd be like, sure. But obviously, like, I wanted to look after him, but he's also, I get on with him. But it was kind of stopping me to a certain point of, to a certain degree, I mean, I'm not talking like a lot of it, but to a certain degree, it was stopping me from living the life that I wanted to lead, which, you know, I always wanted to go to America. I always wanted to play on the LPGA and play to the best of my ability. And I finally feel that this winter was the first time that I actually allowed myself that permission.
I remember when you started working with Kevin Craggs, mm-hmm. You spoke then about that was a bit of a turning point. So looking back, obviously, maybe it was a building
mm-hmm,
block.
For sure, yeah. Like, me and Kev obviously don't work together now, but when I first worked with him, he was a really good guy to kind of lean on. You know, he really supported me from not just a golf point of view, but, you know, him and his family took me in like another family member. They were, you know, I have a lot of credit to give to them. And
so this is now around 2014.
Yeah.
So a couple of years later.
So that was certainly a building block. And then, you know, got into a steady relationship. That also was a slight building block. And then this winter, I kind of feel was like the kind of the last stage, like not necessarily the last stage, but I feel like it was certainly is getting towards the end of like the grieving process, I should say.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
Because you played Solheim Cup again in 2015. Mm-hmm. And of course, it happened to be mm-hmm. in Germany as well, of all the places. Your family are there as well. And I remember, you know, working, commentating. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was just my mind working this way, but I had a lump in my throat when you were performing as well as you were. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you and as a family, especially being in Germany?
It was first time we'd all been back. So for me, it was huge for me to get in that Solheim, personally. Like, I was so determined to get in it because I wanted it all to go back as a family. And it sounds kind of weird, but I felt like there would have been like a full circle. And yeah, I just had it on me that week. I was not letting anyone beat me. And, you know, I did go unbeaten in the four matches I played, I was unbeaten. And, you know, again, that was probably one of the most impressive weeks of my career just because of the emotional attachment to it.
Yeah, I mean, it came through in your game. So it's interesting because, you know, sometimes being an emotional golfer isn't good, but you proved that week that it can raise your game.
Yeah. I mean, if you use it to the correct way, it can definitely enhance your game for sure.
And what was that like for your dad, you know?
I don't know. I think he's not the most, like, emotional of blokes.
Okay.
But, you know, I know him well enough without him needing to say anything that, you know, that was kind of a special week for him and the family as well.
Yeah. And has America been what you hoped it would be?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I miss home. Don't get me wrong, I miss the lifestyle here. I miss my friends, I miss my family. But for me to change the world the way I want to change it, I have to, right now, the right move is for me to be in America.
So just explain that.
I just feel like, you know, I want to play good golf. I want to have a voice. I have a lot of opinions. I think the media know that. But I do want to change the way people see golf, honestly. Women's golf.
Are you worried that having an opinion still, though? I mean,
not really.
Because you say it almost...
I know, because I sometimes get myself in trouble. But I believe that if you're not outspoken, nothing changes. So
I mean, look at that interview we started the interview with, 2008.
And I love playing good golf. Like, I enjoy playing well and I hate playing badly. And for me, it just allows me to train all year round, which has made a massive difference.
So in terms of you publicly coming out as gay, your family, I assume, knew.
Yeah, and I think when I was born.
Right, so they know in a while. So you weren't really coming out, were you? You were just making it a public thing to do. How long had you thought about that?
So my other best friend, Molly Gallatin, who works for PGA of America, she was like, you know what, I really think you would make a difference if you came out. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then she says, look, I found this Athlete Ally, who are a fantastic company who really support gay athletes. And I just think it'd be a really good connection for you. And, you know, let's just get them in touch and let's just figure out what the next step is. And so I did the story a while ago. So it was about 6 months before it actually came out, before we were okay for it coming out. But, you know, I've got a huge credit really to give to Molly, because, you know, people kind of obviously latched on to the sexuality thing. That's obviously why I did it, but I did it as well because a lot of golfers give back in many, many ways through charities and things like that. And this was my way of giving back. Like, I've seen firsthand how people get treated in the LGBTQ community, and a lot of them are my friends. And I've seen that families don't accept it, and I've seen how detrimental it can be, either because of people's opinions or because people aren't educated on it and they're scared of it. And, you know, it destroys people, and it stops people being who they really are, and it makes them sad. And so for me, if I made one bit of difference to one person or one family member that was like, oh, you know, my brother came out gay, and I had a completely different, you know, perspective on it after hearing your story, then I've done my job. That was kind of me, what I wanted to do it for, and to just kind of educate that, you know, it's this, you gotta be who you are, because otherwise you just get so lost in this crazy world now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough enough world as it is without hiding who you are. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you said, you know, you spoke to Molly and that kind of spurred you on, but you must have been thinking about this quite a while.
Yeah, because I would go to dinners and, you know, I'm proud of who I'm with. And so it was kind of I was probably making it more awkward, but I would go to dinners or prom parties and introduce my partner as my roommate or my friend. And I was like, why am I doing that? Like, that's really not very fair on us. It's not certainly not fair.
You knew why you were doing
that. Yeah, of course. And like, I was almost protecting myself, or I almost didn't want the other people to feel awkward. That's kind of the main reason. But it just got to a point where I just was kind of comfortable with myself. And I thought, I should just be as normal about it as I try and tell people they should be normal.
And what's the reaction been like then?
Just normal, honestly. Like, really good, yeah. I mean, obviously, you get the odd person that...
Sure.
Obviously, which I expect, but 99.9%, everyone's been incredible. And I was actually more shocked, like, a lot of players got in touch with me and was like, mate, that was awesome. And that's kind of... I was a little bit nervous about that. And so, for me, that was a huge moment for me, was when the players were getting in touch with me and saying, mate, that was a really cool thing what you did. You know, good on you, pat on the back. And that meant a lot to me.
Because also, there's a commercial... side of this as well, isn't there? I've read that you were worried that maybe sponsors might think, okay, I don't want to be associated with you.
Yeah.
But how has that been from a...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think sponsorship is absolutely thriving in women's golf right now, like for individual. I don't think it's thriving in golf in general, to be honest. But
do you think it's made you a more attractive proposition?
I would like to think so, yeah, because, you know, I don't want a company sponsoring me who doesn't agree with that. That's not... I don't want that. I don't want to be part of that anymore. And so it'd be against my morals. So it's very important for me that companies who want to represent me, I want to represent them as well. You know, I've got a fantastic company, Aggreko, who straight away came on board, and they're awesome. You know,
but you still got a blank hat.
Yeah.
Blank hat. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would never happen to a PGA Tour player, but it's happening to an LPGA Tour player.
I know. A lot of girls are like that.
I mean, just elaborate.
But a lot of girls just won't wear blank hats. They will just wear a hat and they're not getting paid for it. They just, I'm like, what are you doing? So I refused to do it. I was like, I'm not doing it. Because I think it makes a statement.
Because here we are, we've talked about a lot of progress.
Mm-hmm.
Still a long way to go,
isn't it? A long way. I think, look, I'm not stupid. I know that it will never be equal pay. I know that TV rights have a huge amount to do with it. We need respect, I think, is the big thing here. Women's sport in general needs respect. I think, you know, men's golf doesn't know how lucky it really is. We don't get me wrong, we have some fantastic sponsors on the LPGA that have come in, given us brand new tournaments. Mike Wan's doing an unbelievable job and his staff are doing an unbelievable job. But it's the little things, like the manufacturers don't respect women's golf as much as men's golf.
So what's it like for you? So say, let's say you're playing in the practice here this mm-hmm. week. We're at the Ladies Scottish Open at the moment. Say your 3-wood breaks. What happens?
Well, I go with companies who are very supportive of women's golf. I do that for a reason. So, yeah, I mean, look, you've got 3 or 4 tour reps who are out every single week on the LPGA who are awesome. Hugely support women's golf, but you still have the big companies or a couple of the big companies that just bat an eyelid. Like, they're trying to do a little bit more now. I don't know if my article, I did an article at the start of the year about it.
What, where you said that certain players, like, you know, Imbi
I just Park was like, yeah, I just, yeah, I was
she
like,
couldn't get a club.
Yeah, and she was world number one. I mean, that to me, yet they, you know, they pay the big boys millions upon millions upon millions just to use their products. And again, the whole thing about respect is what I'm saying is you walk into a pro shop, you see the John Rahms, you see obviously the Rorys, you see the Dustins. Absolutely, you should be seeing them. They're the best players in the world. But you should also be seeing the Lexis, in my opinion, like the Lauras, you know, the Corders. Like, that's also who you should be seeing. And
I've spent a bit of time in Korea. Covering men's events, being there for...
It's all women.
It is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are examples. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously a rare example, but there are examples where it is that way around.
Yeah, it is. But there's not as many male pros as in Korea as there is as for women. Like, the women have just... They're just way ahead of the men right now, whereas we have 2 established tours. So I just believe that... I don't know. I just believe that manufacturers should respect women's golf more than what they do.
Okay. Is it getting worse, or do you think...
I think it's got slightly better over the last few months, but it was definitely getting worse there for a while.
Okay, so you've got a voice, and I want to talk about what the round as well that's coming up, which mm-hmm. is one of the majors this year. But in terms of, you know, still talking about, you know, you speaking out... Listen, we're at the Scottish Open. It's the last qualifying mm-hmm. event for the Solheim Cup. You obviously want to be playing in the Solheim Cup. Mm-hmm. If you're not, you might be sitting next to me.
Commentating on it.
Yeah, well, there's an incentive to make sure you play in the Solheim Cup. But that is something you are interested in, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
You'd like to be doing this kind of thing, interviewing someone and...
I certainly, after my career has finished or I'm fed up of it, I definitely would like to get into the commentating and broadcasting, for sure. Like, I just really enjoy it. I really enjoy...
You've done some radio already, haven't you?
Face of radio. So I've done some radio.
Yeah, me
and...
too, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I just love the on-course stuff. I love, you know, talking about, I think as well, being a player, it has a little bit of a different outlook on the game. So I think that it's definitely something that I'm interested in, for sure.
Yeah. But as we say, we don't know when this interview goes out, we'll know whether you're playing
or
unfortunately commentating next mm-hmm. to me at the Solheim Cup. In terms of the Solheim Cup, if let's say you are commentating with me, I mean, is that something you can contemplate and tell me?
I don't
me?
Know. I've not... Obviously, I don't know. If I don't get in, I'm not sure if I could do it because, again, I'm competitive. I want to be on the Solheim Cup. So I don't know. Right now, like, that's honestly... That's the fire in my belly is Solheim Cup. Like, I love Solheim Cup more than any other event in this planet. So it would be quite hard for me not to be there in the team and be there. So we'll see. But it's certainly the thing that gets me going is Solheim Cup.
Yeah. I mean, your record at the Solheim, we've mentioned mm-hmm. 2011, we've mentioned 2015. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you played in 2017 mm-hmm. as well. You've shown you've got plenty of people you can partner with, the team thing. Do you mm-hmm. think that's, again, to do with some of the other sports you played as well?
For sure. Like, you know, I've always said I feel like I give a little bit more than just my golf game. You know, I felt... Especially the last one in 2017, I felt like I took a little bit of a different role to previous Solheims. I felt, because I'd played, that was my 3rd one, and I felt like I kind of took a lot of the rookies under my wing and you know, the dynamics of the team are certainly changing. It wasn't, you know, there was a lot of big personalities in 2011, and then, you know, I just feel like the dynamics kind of shifted a little bit, and so, you know, you've...
Let's put it this way, you're vocal, is that
I'm
what you
vocal,
mean?
I'm vocal, yeah,
so
basically.
You would add certainly a bit of character.
Yeah, I think, obviously, I could name a bunch of other players that would as well, but, so yeah, I think you have to have that. Like, we, on paper, the Americans are 9 times out of 10 going to be stronger than us, on paper. But the way that we will win any Solheim Cup is through character. And that's what we do have an advantage over, if the dynamic is right.
Yeah, I mean, you have sat out the Solheim Cup 2013, but obviously you were in a very different place then. Did you watch 2013?
No. I didn't. I went on holiday.
Did you?
Yeah, I went on holiday with my friends. Didn't watch one shot. Couldn't do it.
You're just so gutted not
to be
there.
I was gutted. Yeah.
Even given.
Yeah, and I was playing rubbish, so there was no chance of me ever getting in.
And obviously you'd gone through,
yeah,
you know.
There's no chance of me getting in, but I couldn't watch it. I just couldn't. I sent the girls a good luck message, like, but come Friday, I couldn't watch it. Yeah. Couldn't watch it.
Wow, so that's...
I sometimes struggle when I'm not in, like, US Opens and stuff. I can't watch it on TV. It drives me nuts.
Okay, but you played some majors this year.
Yeah.
Which brings us to where we're at. Because so you've gone to America, mm-hmm. and you've, in terms of your golf game, you've changed pretty
everything.
Much everything.
Yeah.
So go through the changes.
So I changed coach middle of last year to Jorge Parada. So when I moved to America, I'd worked with him for about 5 months. Changed my trainer, obviously, because I was in America, to a guy called Ken McDonald, who, apart from Jorge, has made probably a huge difference, like a huge difference to my game.
Go on, what do you, because people might not understand. He's a trainer, as a physical
mm-hmm.
trainer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how would
strength
he,
and conditioning, yeah.
So go on, just briefly explain to people why that would make such a difference.
I can kind of only talk for me. I've always said that golf is very athletic. I think that the pressure that we put our bodies under, the speed that we hit the ball and the amount we travel, you know, the amount that we hit golf balls, like I think golfers practice more than any other athlete to a certain degree. And so that strain in your body takes its toll. And for me, I'm built for as a long distance runner, I have zero muscle. So I have to constantly build muscle because I find it very hard to maintain muscle. So to get him on board, he's created a lot more stability, a lot more strength in my lower body. He challenges my body. He doesn't kind of isolate body parts. And so everything that we do is constantly getting challenged, which is what I love about him. And he's just an all-around good guy, to be honest. But yeah, I think it's hugely important, especially for girls. Like, girls on a whole are not built hugely strong. You obviously get the odd one. Like, Charlie's built for power, for example. Aria Chichanagon's built for power naturally, whereas I'm just not. So I have to work very hard at it.
But you are a powerful player.
Mm-hmm.
But you've, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, whenever, I mean, I've watched you kind of when you were coming onto tour, so I've seen you through the last mm-hmm. decade, you always seem to be a...
athletic.
And a great ball striker.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think I give myself a bit of a hard time about my ball striking, but, I mean, for me, I feel my best when I'm at my fittest, honestly.
Okay. So trainer, coach...
So trainer, coach, changed my caddy.
Clubs.
Changed my clubs, changed all my equipment pretty much.
Changed home, as we've mentioned.
Changed my home. Yeah, so I changed a lot in a short space of time. So,
and
yeah.
Is that easy to deal with? I mean, it seems a lot to... It could be destabilising.
Yeah, I mean, you have to trust the process. I know it sounds stupid and everyone kind of says that. But you do, you have to trust the process. You have to trust your instincts on these kinds of things. And, you know, it takes you a while to adapt. When you change that much all at the same time, it takes a lot to adapt. And so you have to give yourself a little bit of patience as well.
So when we're forward into the season, the results aren't showing. How hard is it to sort of stick to what you call the process?
Well, that's why you pick the team you do, you know, because obviously it can be quite disheartening, like when you're not getting the results that you feel like you deserve. And so that's where I've got to give a lot of credit to Jorge.
And you knew it was Solheim year?
I knew it was Solheim year. I didn't even expect to be anywhere near Solheim, honestly. Like that kind of, obviously I would have liked to have been somewhat in Beanie's earshot no matter how I played in the year, because I just love Solheim so much and I usually play relatively well in it. But yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't, it was at the very, very back of my mind, honestly. Like, I just wanted to play well and get in Asia. That was kind of my goal at the year, was to get in the Asian events at the end of the year, so be top 60 on the middle list. So yeah, I mean, that's why I've got to give a lot of credit to Jorge, to Ken, to my team, really, is that...
Ken being...
My trainer.
Okay.
You know, to not get disheartened and to keep doing the right things. If you do the right things, eventually good things will happen.
And this brings us to the round you've chosen. So of all the rounds that, you know, I've mentioned, your first win, you know, what happened in Prague, coming back, getting a win again after everything that had happened, you know, in 2015, you've chosen a round. Is it because it's closest, or do you think it is because it's what I asked you to be, in a way, the most significant round of your career, which is, we'll say it's at Hazeltine, KPMG, the women's PGA final round.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of both, honestly. You know, it was just a big moment for me because it was the first time in a long time that it sounds silly, but I felt like I could win. You know, I hadn't really come into any form. And I actually said at the start of the week, I think it helped as well. Like, I had my people there. I had, like, Molly there, I had my partner there. Like, I was in a very stable environment that week. And so, you know, I said to Molly at the start of the week, I was like, there's no way I'm finishing outside top five this week. And she was like, oh, let's do it, best mate. Like, we're having a joke about it, having a beer about it. And then I was like, no, seriously, mate. And she's like, yeah, no. But if you'd have looked at my form, there was no way I was going to have a top five. But I just had a feeling, just because my people were there. Like, it makes a huge difference.
When you say, so Molly's, did she not always been out?
No, because Molly, that's the only event, PGA of America run that event. So she was there, you know, it just so happened that my partner was there at the time. And so, you know, I just, like, Jorge was there. Like, it just so happened that I was just in a good place. And, like,
You started the week well as well. Yeah. So it kind of,
it helped that it was raining, it was windy, it was horrible weather, and that helped me. I actually said to Behan, my caddy, I was like, this is where people are just going to lose this event. And I was like, let's just keep this around par. And it will feel like a 66. And so I started the round with 3 under, which, you know, in that weather was almost like a 66, honestly, or 65. So started the week really well. And then it's the first time that I felt very comfortable with my golf swing as well. For all the changes we made, it was the first time I felt very free.
And then you made 36 putts on Friday.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, back to my old self again. But it was.
But it didn't, obviously, given what happened next, didn't knock you back.
No, and Hazeltine's not an easy golf course. You know, if you're not quite on it, it's a very difficult golf course. And so, just didn't putt well. I didn't hit it as well as the day before. You know, my Fridays haven't been great this year. I don't know why. It's not that I feel any different. It's just the way that it is. I don't know whether it's with sleep or whatever it is. But, yeah, didn't have a great Friday. And then Saturday was a big day as well because I was 1 over with four to play. And I finished 2 under. I birdied 3 of the last 4. That was a huge for me as well. And then on the last day, I played with So-Yeon Ru and who else did I play with? But two lovely girls. I can't remember the third player. That sounds really bad. But that's both nice. Of them are just lovely girls.
But you didn't start great.
Didn't start great. I met three. Yeah, what did I do on the first?
Couple bogeyed of bogeys first, early on, yeah.
Bogeyed the first and third, which was stupid. From the middle of the fairway, both of them. And then I was just hitting everything really close. I was sitting there, I think I hit it to 4 foot, 6 foot. 7, I hold a great putt. 8.
You make 7 birdies.
Yeah, 8 birdies.
It was 8 birdies,
yeah,
beg your pardon.
Bogeys, yeah.
Yeah. So at what point are you thinking, might have a chance here?
Birdie 9 to get to 3 under for the front 9, I think. And then I knew 10 was a difficult hole, so I parred that. And then, I don't know, just from there I just...
Were you thinking about winning?
Yeah. All I thought about, first time in a long time, instead of trying to almost guide it around, I was thinking birdies. So I just was, that's all I thought about was, right, let's just birdie this one, let's birdie this one, let's birdie this one. It was the first time in a long time that I've thought just, let's just make as many birdies as possible. Which sounds weird really, but.
It does, from where I'm sitting as well. Having watched you and seen you win and.
Mm-hmm. But you just get weeks like that. Like, I just, that's all I was thinking about was just birdies the whole week.
So. And then you finish and you know, you're right in with a chance. Obviously you've finished a long way before Hannah Green and the final groups have finished. I read a quote somewhere about you having to put the beers on hold.
Yeah. One of the officials rang me and she was like, really well played, I hope you're not having a beer. And I was like, my friends just ordered me and she went, don't you dare drink it just yet. I was like, okay. So I sat in the clubhouse for like 2 hours just with people and just chilling and then I had a beer when I knew I wasn't going to win.
Okay, I mean, you're kind of hoping.
I actually thought I had a chance because it wasn't easy coming in. I think Greenie bogeyed like 14 or something as well. So she got it back to 8. So she's only 1 shot ahead of me. 15's not easy. 16 wasn't easy. 17 isn't easy. 18's not easy. So I actually thought generally I had a pretty good chance. But, you know, obviously she had a really, really strong finish. And deserved it.
But you had your best ever major finish, mm-hmm. third yeah. place. Mm-hmm. Is the significance of it because of, you know, we've said it already, all those changes that you've made, which could be a gamble mm-hmm. to see the fruits of that labour and those changes?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, just that freed me up, honestly. Like, it's got me my card for next year. It's probably got me into all the Asian events. It got me a chance to get in Solheim. Like, it just completely freed me up. And so, you know, I can certainly just play with a lot more freedom because I've been playing with quite a bit of stress the last couple of years. You know, like, I support myself. I don't have any support from, you know, I don't ask my friends and family for support. Like, I do it all on my own, which was another reason I was so proud that I kind of did it as well, because I took a huge risk going to America. Like, I literally sold my house and put everything into my golf of my own money.
How'd you watch Derby County when you were in America?
I don't know.
You know,
don't worry, I've got one of those little sticks. I still get started okay. Sky Sports, don't worry.
Yeah, fair enough. So, listen, I'm sure you're aware of it. You know, fantastic performance. In terms of the career we've just talked about in the last 45 minutes or more, are you aware of what a roller coaster it's been?
Yeah, I mean, this game honestly drives me nuts. Like, I love and hate it all at the same time, you know, and sometimes I think I take for granted what I do and the privilege that I have of playing golf as a career. I think we all are to blame for it sometimes is, you know, it's a complete privilege to play a game that we love for a living, and I sometimes take that completely for granted, and I catch myself sometimes. But yeah, I mean, you know, we talk about I'd love to get into broadcasting, but I don't feel I'm anywhere near ready to quit. I don't feel like I'm going to be like a Laura Davies and still playing over, you know, onto the seniors tour. I don't feel that'll be me either, but I certainly feel like I'm nowhere near reaching any of my potential. And, you know, there's still a few things that I need to kind of just, you know, I kind of feel I know what is my weakness. And so, you know,
what do you think that is then? You don't have to say.
I think I know what it is. I think that because of what's happened to me, I sometimes struggle to say no to things. And so I do too much sometimes. I think that sometimes I am invincible when actually I need to put myself first. I feel like I put a lot of other things first sometimes.
It's interesting because when we were arranging to this interview as well here, like yesterday I said to you, this is now Wednesday before a mm-hmm. tournament. I said, you're here to play yeah. a golf tournament yeah. first. And you were kind of trying to say, when did I want? I was like, no.
Yeah.
It's up to you when you want to do this. Like, so is that what you mean, that sort of thing?
You know what, like sometimes when I've arranged dinner with friends at 8 o'clock at night and I'm absolutely shattered because I've been training all day, I should just be like, do you know what, guys, I'm so sorry. Like, I'm just going to have to call it a night. Like, I just need to go to bed. And instead I don't, because I feel like I don't want to let people down, or I have a fear of missing out, obviously, as well. Like, that's just who I am. And so I think at times, I mean, you could call it discipline, but I've got a little bit better with it recently, but I need to listen to what is right for me instead of either living up to an expectation of what people have of me or even just trying to please other people. I think I could be a little bit more selfish in that respect.
Yeah, it's kind of growing up and going yeah, with yeah. your instinct.
I might realise it when I'm on the seniors tour. Just I'm not doing it, but I might be there. Laura will still be on it, so that'll be all right.
Yeah, you'll have good company. Oh, it's been great to talk.
No problem. Mel, You're very welcome.
It's been a really interesting chat. Thanks.
Good. You're welcome.
Well, what a great way to end the series. Mel's a very articulate golfer, isn't she? She'll make a very good broadcaster, obviously, in years to come. Hopefully, her openness will allow others to follow a similar path, an easier passage maybe in expressing themselves and being who they are, like she has done there. I wonder how long before a male golfer feels that the environment within the tour and the commercial response is such that he's comfortable enough to do the same. It'd be interesting to see how that all pans out. Now, since we did the interview, of course, Mel found out she won't be in the Solheim Cup team. She didn't get one of Katrina Matthews' picks. And having listened to this, you won't be surprised, would you, to guess how gutted she would be at not getting into the 12. She's taken the role as vice-captain. I'm sure she'll do that very well, but I'm sure she'll just be even more determined to make the next team, having missed out this time. Now, it's been a thrill for me spending time with major champions, Hall of Famers, and professionals from the men and women's game to bring you this podcast. We've had some incredible stories told, haven't we? Just to run you down the list of who's been in this series, the Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington, one of the greatest of all time, Gary Player, Lizette Salas joined us, didn't she? What an incredible story. She almost, of course, had this year a first major win like Mel. She's going to be a big part of that Solheim Cup team. Michael Campbell, great to hear him back playing golf again. Davis Love the third. What an incredible story, I suppose, like Mel Reid that we just heard from, suffering tragedy within the family. Cary Webb, one of those players who goes down as the greats. Danny Willett, obviously good to see him back in some kind of form as well. And what a story with him in the Masters. John Morgan, what a reaction we had from you with that podcast. Nicholas Kolsarts told a fantastic story as well. Christy Kerr, Ollie Fisher and the 59, Ryan Fox. Jazz Jane Wattenanond as well, one of the up-and-coming stars. We heard from Katrina Matthew, the Solheim Cup captain. Jeev Milka Singh, of course, was the last podcast that we had as well. So thanks to your reaction to that. Thanks to all the golfers who have given up their time to allow me to do this. And go back in the archives, because the interviews are timeless. So this shouldn't be like some other podcast. Once you've got it out there that week, it's old news. These are podcasts you can go back to and enjoy at any time. Thanks as well to Red Ray, Navigate Contracting, for putting in some sponsorship money. And I'd love to keep the podcast going. I'm very proud of it. Your reaction through the series suggests you think it's worth a listen. But that's something I suppose I'm going to think about in the coming months. Love to hear your thoughts, though, how you think it maybe could be a better podcast, or what guests you'd love to hear from, or maybe you or your company is interested in sponsoring the potential next series. So get in touch. You can do so at The Round Podcast on Twitter, at The Round Golf Podcast on Facebook, or you can just get in touch with me directly on my Twitter handle, which is at Kaufman Richard. But for now, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Round with Richard Kaufman. You can follow us and get in touch via Twitter at The Round Podcast, on Instagram, Podcast The Round, and on Facebook at The Round Richard Kaufman. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to rate and review us on iTunes. The Round Podcast with Richard Kaufman, in association with IMG Audio.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk. Breathe, rechalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.